Press the headlines, a Russian investigator says the Pentagon and some U.S. companies have spent millions of dollars in developing Ukraine's bioweapons program since 2005. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran will continue diplomatic efforts to achieve a final agreement on reviving the 2015 deal, saying it's U.S. turn to adopt a realistic approach. And Iran and Venezuela confirmed they're looking to bolster energy cooperation after a visit by Iran's oil minister to Caracas. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in at World News. Our top story, a top Russian investigator says that the U.S. has been involved in Ukraine's bioweapons development program. Alexander Bastarykin says the analysis of obtained documents show representatives from the Pentagon and certain American firms have been involved in biological military activities in Ukraine. Now the Russian investigator says Washington has spent over $224 million since 2005 on such programs in Ukraine. He says the sum has been funneled into about 30 research centers run by Ukraine's defense, health, and agricultural ministries. Russia has long accused Ukraine of pursuing a U.S.-funded bioweapons program that, amid Washington's allegations that Moscow could launch a chemical attack on its western neighbor, a claim the Kremlin vehemently denies. Joining us now from San Francisco, California, is Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer, for more on the story. Hello, Scott. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. Your thoughts on the, I mean, we've been hearing about the reports of this from the very first day of what's taking place in Ukraine, February 24th, I believe it was, Scott. How much of it do you think is reality? How much of it do you think is inflated false news?
Well, I know for a fact it's reality because I participated in the documentary of RT called Death Factories, in which we exposed all of this and examined the documents. And that came out over a year or so ago. So we knew over a year ago about these bio labs and their experiments and the documents. We knew about the contractors. We knew about it originally starting in 2005 with the Defense Intelligence Agency that then created a 501c3 called the Global Viral Forecasting Institute with a Zionist Mossad operative named Nathaniel Wolf that then became Metabiota to make it more of a harmless name. And that Metabiota was being funded by Rosemont Fonseca, an investment firm that, ironically enough, Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, was the head of, along with Christopher Hines, who was the son of John Kerry, and Paul Pelosi Jr., the son of Nancy Pelosi. So this is a incestuous, corrupt, criminal racketeering operation that the West has been developing under Obama, under Biden, under, for the last 10 years, for the purposes of generating DNA biological chemical warfare to use against the Russians. That's why they've been collecting DNA samples from Slavic people. And of course, all of the documents and the evidence that General Igor Krylyov has found and commented on are all being exposed as revelations of a massive, really war crime, crime against humanity, because it's a violation of the Global Biological Chemical Weapons Agreement. It's really showing that America, with its 30 bio labs in Ukraine, was involved in experimentation on animal-to-human transmission, which is precisely the origin of COVID-19. So I think you're going to see all of this research that was conducted in Ukraine being directly connected to COVID-19. And there you have the Pandora's box that was created and opened by the United States of America.
And Scott, do you think this is something that the U.S. is doing, basically using Ukraine to do it for itself, or do you think it's something, a joint venture with the Ukrainian government? And to what end do you think these labs were operating to achieve what?
Well, the Ukrainian government was easily toppled and manipulated by the West. They were bought off. They were brainwashed. They're a very susceptible, malleable group of people. They're also the far-right Nazi types that Lavrov has indicated, you know, the Jewish Israeli Nazis are just like the German Nazis in World War II. There's no difference. They were picking Ukraine because of its proximity to Russia, as well as its DNA makeup that is extraordinarily similar to the Russian ethnic communities in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So the West has been planning a germ biochemical warfare weaponization against Russia and its people for over 20, 30 years. So this was a collaboration by the State Department, the Department of Defense, the Biden administration, Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi. That's one of the reasons they went over there to talk to Zelensky last week, is because they are frantic that they are going to be indicted in global war crimes and crimes against humanity, as they should. So this is a massive event that they can't run away from. And I think you're going to see all of Europe, when they start to irreparably face the music, they're going to turn against this American regime of criminals, pirates, and plunderers. And I think this is just the beginning. And Russia is progressing very slowly and methodically. But it's horrendous when you read the documents, and I have, and again, I participated in the documentary, and there's a third part coming out. They have entertained the development of ticks and fleas to put into birds and then send these birds migrating into portions of Russia. They have also sought to aerosolize, turn into vapor, certain pathogens, including the plague and many other very merciless diseases and sicknesses. And this is a terrible weapon that they have been purposely developing against Russia for the purposes of weakening Russia, cannibalizing it, dismembering it, breaking it up. And this has been part of the policy since the 1990s to exploit Russia. But thankfully, I think you're seeing Russia rise from these terrible attacks. And I think with all the truth revealing, you're going to see the mass community of nations standing against this. And you're also seeing the multipolar world rising up. So Iran, Russia, China, and other countries in Europe, I think, are going to emerge into a much stronger position the more they drop themselves from the SWIFT system and the European banking system and the petrodollar. So with one falling, another rises. So I think we're on the beginning of seeing a new rise, but this is a very key issue. The revelation of Biological and Chemical Weapons Department as a official Department of Defense contract with Black and Veatch and companies like Defense Contractors and the State Department and Fort Detrick and others. This is a terrible crime that warrants a Nuremberg hearing, and hopefully the same fate will fall those death factory politicians and scientists as was met in Nuremberg in 1945, and that is execution.
All right, thank you. Stay safe. Always a pleasure to check in with you, Scott, from San Francisco, California. Scott Bennett there joining us. Meanwhile, Iran says it will continue on the path of diplomacy to achieve a final agreement on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Irish counterpart, Simon Coveney. Iran's top diplomat said it's now the turn of the U.S. to adopt a realistic stance. He said that Washington must make up for the illegal approach of former President Donald Trump and come up with a political initiative. The Irish foreign minister, for his part, praised Iran's initiative and highlighted the importance of an agreement that will satisfy the demands of all sides. Amir Abdollahian had said earlier in the day that the talks in Vienna were not stopped, but they're continuing in a different format. Iran is demanding a complete removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not quit the deal again. Earlier, we reached out to journalist and commentator John Bosnich for his take on the Iranian foreign minister's remarks. He says a revival of the deal will or could turn out to become one of the few achievements that the embattled U.S. Democrats can boast about during Biden's term in office.
To be honest, I would say that it's one of their lowest priorities. I'm sure they're under heavy pressure from Israel to just shelve the matter indefinitely. However, Joe Biden is doing a terrible job as president. He's seen the collapse of the U.S. reputation, and he is seeing a complete reversal of decades of aggressive U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine as we speak. So I think that if there were a possibility for an easy and a fair resolution of the Iran issue, it could be used by his party, because I think he's not really making the decisions anymore, but it could be used by his party as a sign of some sort of success during his presidency. That's up to his advisors to determine, because I think really Joe Biden is fading as an individual right before our very eyes.
Iran's oil minister is in Venezuela as two major oil producing countries are looking forward to boosting ties while under U.S. sanctions. Javad Oji, who is heading a delegation to Caracas, has met with President Nicolas Maduro and other high-ranking officials. In a tweet, Oji pointed to a long history of Tehran-Caracas relations and said the two nations want to use all their capacities to develop ties further. Maduro also called his meeting with the Iranian minister productive and expressed a desire to deepen brotherly ties and cooperation in the energy sector. Earlier, OG met with his Venezuelan counterpart, Tarek El Aissami. According to a statement by the Venezuelan Petroleum Ministry, the meeting was aimed at discussing ways to overcome coercive measures imposed on the two countries by the U.S. and its allies. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nuri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Haq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nuri's family as they enter a court building. Footage shows Swedish police failing to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nuri's wife laments the Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest Nuri's detention and trial. The ministry said it considers Nuri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group, the MKO. Ministry rejected allegations against Nuri as baseless and described his trial as political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Leader of the Roman Catholic Church blames the Western military alliance NATO for potentially provoking Russia to launch war on Ukraine. Pope Francis said that NATO's, quote, barking at Russia's doorstep and its eastward expansion may have facilitated the Kremlin's reaction. He explained further that the war in Ukraine was caused by other countries, but he did condemn what he called the brutality of the war. The pontiff also offered to meet the Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss ways to bring peace between the two neighbors. Putin had not reacted to the remarks which Francis made during an interview with an Italian daily. Russia and the U.S.-led NATO remain divided over a host of issues. Tensions escalated in late February after Moscow initiated a military offensive against Ukraine. The United Nations says over 100 civilians have reached safety in the city of Zaporizhia after being evacuated from the besieged Ukrainian port city of Mariupol. The evacuation was coordinated by the International Committee of the Red Cross. A UN humanitarian official says a convoy consists of women, children, and the elderly. It took them 3 days to reach Zaporizhia after evacuation from a steel plant in Mariupol, where they were holed up for over 2 months. Russia has already declared that it has taken over the strategic port. The Ukrainian military says Russian forces, backed by armored vehicles and tanks, have now launched a powerful attack on the steel complex. Kiev has also accused Moscow of planning to send a large number of infantry by boat. Turkey says it's planning to repatriate over 1 million Syrian refugees and resettle them in northwestern Idlib province, despite fears of renewed violence there. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan made the announcement in a video address. He said Ankara will facilitate the return of Syrians by building them housing and local infrastructure. Erdogan said his government will work with international and local civil society organizations to reach the goal. Over 3.6 million Syrians have crossed over into Turkey since foreign-backed insurgency began in Syria in 2011. Erdogan says around 500,000 refugees have already returned and that Turkey plans to encourage more to do so. But critics say the move could make the situation worse as many of these refugees are potentially former militants. Idlib is seen as a safe haven for terrorists fighting the Syrian government. The British Prime Minister says that his government cannot provide enough financial support to ease the pain of the current cost of living in the country for months ahead.
Because I accept that those contributions from the taxpayer, because that's what it is, taxpayers' money, isn't going to be enough immediately to help cover everybody's costs. Of course that isn't going to work in enough in the short term.
So you acknowledge you're not doing everything
you can. There is more that we can do.
Yes.
But the crucial thing is to make sure we deal with the prices over the medium and long term. Although you're quite right to point out that there is an inflationary risk and it's very severe, it could get worse. And that knocks onto interest rates and that knocks onto the cost of borrowing for everybody. And I'm sorry to say this, but we have to be prudent in our approach. We're not saying...
Johnson rejected the prospect of raising welfare benefits in line with inflation, arguing such a measure can potentially drive inflation even higher. The Prime Minister also rebuffed the idea of a windfall tax on oil and gas giants, saying that move could discourage energy companies from making investments. Now, Britain is grappling with soaring inflation, which hit a 30-year high of 7.5% in March. That, coupled with the war in Ukraine, is taking a toll on the British economy. Surging prices are contributing to the biggest squeeze on household incomes since the 1950s. Retail sales and consumer confidence have also fallen significantly in recent months. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard on Imam Khomeini's struggles against the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, especially his opposition to the so-called White Revolution, which was a plan to legitimize the Shah rule. This time, we are going to dwell upon the events which led to the imam's arrest in 1963. As you know, we have tried to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the imam. Stay with us, please. Imam Khomeini's opposition to the ceremonial referendum of the Shah awakened political groups, and they accompanied the imam in the struggles. But the regime announced that the referendum was successful, and most of the people voted for it. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, at the threshold of the Iranian calendar year 1342, corresponding with March 1963, announced a public mourning. The imam said, "I announce this feast, Nowruz, as mourning for the Muslim community in order to make Muslims aware of the dangers ahead of the Quran and the country." The imam had smartly announced that Nowruz as mourning day, not due to the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, but rather for the conspiracy of colonialists against Islam and the Quran. He said in a speech on the last day of Isfand 1342, corresponding with 1963, "This year we have no feast, and I announce this feast as a public mourning, not because of coincidence with the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, who has a lofty status, but due to the disasters and losses that have been inflicted on Islam. This year was not a happy year for Muslims. In this year, colonialism schemed plots against Islam. The wicked agents of colonialism insulted the Quran. They designed plans to violate the luminous laws of the Quran. They designed schemes and have plots in mind. If Muslims know what plots and designs are underway against the dignity of Islam, the happiness of Muslim nations and independence of Islamic countries, they will never mark feast." The announcement of public mourning by Imam Khomeini moved the entire Iranian nation. On the 2nd of Farvardin, the agents of Shah regime intended to disturb the ceremony held at Imam Khomeini's home on the occasion of Imam Sadiq's martyrdom, but they failed. Then, the security agents of the regime assaulted Faizia school in Qom and massacred many seminary students and mourners of Imam Sadiq to cause fear among the public, particularly ulema. However, Imam Khomeini called on people to be resistant and help the injured. The news of the bloody event soon spread to the whole country, and preachers took stances against the brutal regime. Nearly 2 months later, the atmosphere of the country was zealous and inspired by Imam Hussein's epic as Ashura was approaching. Imam Khomeini called on preachers and ulema to expose the Shah's servility to the U.S. and Israel and the dangers of this puppet regime for Islam and Muslims. Thus, people in Tehran held demonstrations in Tehran on the day of Ashura, and many of them and the near cities went to Qom to hear the imam's speech. On that day, Imam Khomeini delivered his historical speech in which he directly addressed the Shah. He said, "Oh, Mr. Shah, I advise you to give up these acts. You are being fooled. I don't like to see everyone giving thanks on the day that you are leaving the country. Do not play this much with the nation. Do not be this much opposed to ulema. Take admonition from your father. Listen to the ulema of religion as they like good for you. by God, Israel has no use for you. The speech of Imam Khomeini against the Shah horrified the regime, and on the following day, some of preachers and people attending the speech were arrested. At midnight, the Imam's house was assaulted and he was arrested. Imam Khomeini's wife relates, "These events continued from the beginning of Muharram till Ashura, leading to that speech. And the next night they came and Ruhollah Khomeini was arrested. The Imam had got up for midnight prayer. From the noise, he understood that what was going. It was 2:30 at midnight. The Imam came to me and said, 'They have come to take me. Don't be upset and make no noise. Awaken others and tell them to be calm.' He was speaking so calmly that he insinuated calm in me. He was telling these words while I could hear the fast and worried gasps of the dastards behind the door of the house. They seemed to be 300 to 400, but there were more on the main street. There, they changed the Imam's car and transferred him from a Volkswagen to a Mercedes. The Imam, seeing the street full of agents, told the one beside him, 'So many people have come to take one?'" Imam Khomeini's wife continues on the night that the Imam was arrested by the agents of the regime. "The sound of gasps became faster. The Imam left me to put on clothes. I was worried, but I awakened the children calmly, telling them that the strangers wanted to enter the house. Everyone woke up, but no one said anything. Everyone was listening to me. Suddenly, the door of our house was open with a kick, and there was a row. I called on everyone to be quiet and didn't let anybody defy the orders as the Imam had asked so. The Imam's shout disturbed the calm in the house as he said, 'What's up? Why are you making so much noise? Our neighbors are asleep. Do not disturb them.' At that moment, the door was broken and they poured into the house. They asked the Imam's whereabouts, and he pointed to his chest, saying with a sneer, 'He is here,' and said, 'I am Khomeini. Do not bother anyone.' The children wanted to shout, but I prevented them. The commander of the enemy asked, 'Is it you?' The Imam said, 'Yes, it is me. What do you want at this time of night?' Three people said in panic, 'Please let us go.' And they took the Imam. Mustafa asked the agents to take him too, but the Imam told him seriously, 'Go back. Whom are you pleading?' After arresting Imam Khomeini, his family was sad, but his wife changed the climate. She says, 'It was getting clear little by little. Our home, the home whose members had lost their father, source of emulation and leader, was interesting. Everyone was sitting stunned in a corner. Suddenly I said, 'Stand up. It is the time of prayer.' And that morning we performed a nice prayer." Imam Khomeini's wife continues, "The Imam would relate that on the way he told them that he wanted to pray, but they didn't let. He told them, 'Stop for a few minutes so that we pray together and then we move.' They didn't permit. Upon my insistence, they just stopped and I stooped and touched the soil and performed tayammum. And I was forced to say my prayer in the car. Then, as I caught the sight of oil reserves of Qom, I said, 'All or many of the miseries of this country stem from oil.' They were so much impressed that one of them said, 'Sir, we will return you. We know that we are guilty, but returning is equal to being shot dead. He was not saying these words for flattery, but he was rather speaking sincerely as he wept.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
So last time, dear Sheikh, we spoke about these outrageous fashion trends we may see and notice in our teenage children. Now, I would like to talk about how we can treat and cure this very weird phenomena in our children.
Correct. Many things are available to handle the scenario, but one of the most important and the primary one that I would say is to keep them occupied. The more they are occupied, the less they have time to think about different things, what they look like, what they're wearing, the color of the shoes, is it matching with their pants, is it matching with their t-shirts. Because it's a free mind. If you don't keep them occupied, you don't give them activities, they have free time to think about. And when they have free time, they spend all this time on themselves. Let me give you my example. When I finished my O-levels and A-levels and I was getting into my university, I was doing multiple courses at a time. I was doing my bachelor's in commerce. I was also going to another institute to learn information technology and programming. And with that, I was also doing the course which is popularly known as chartered accountancy, or the GPA course, you call that in UK, where it gives you the civil and the corporate laws about how to run a business, how to establish a business. And so I kept myself occupied and I had no time to look at myself and think that, oh, does this hairstyle look good or should I go for another hairstyle? Does this kind of a shirt look good on me? Should I opt for another tighter, shorter shirt? So on and so forth. So parents should know, and they should also observe the children and see what are they interested in and give them those kind of activities. Activities which are related to, physical roles like mowing the lawn or taking out the garbage or helping them build some furniture at home.
Right, but Sheikh, wouldn't you say it is a good thing that they care about their appearance?
One part is to look at yourself, keep yourself neat, tidy, and
presentable
and composed. And the other thing is overindulgence. Now, what we see among the teens today is overindulgence. You know, they're more concerned about their looks rather than their financial stability. I have seen and heard of teenagers who spend $3,000 on just their, you know, purse, their bags, or $3,000 on the shades, on the glasses, sunglasses, right?
So you're talking about the extreme cases, because
not just necessarily extreme cases like this, where, you know, they're spending thousands of dollars just for their, you know, the watch or the shoes. I'm talking about overall for an average middle class family. For a child to have a good brand shoes, trousers and shirt and t-shirt is enough. But if they start spending too much time and money on these things, then it's an alarm for you. It's a red sign for you. You should become
So just to summarize, careful. Do not overexpend and do not
exaggeration. In all areas. Right. Underspending means you're unpresentable. Maybe we can, you know, take a break.
Right, let's take a quick break because we need here. To go on a break.
Yeah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, just before we went on a break, we were very busy discussing what it means that you should care about your appearance, but not too much. Because we do have this concept of La Ifrat Wala Tafrit. No over-exaggeration, no under-exaggeration, but a balance.
Correct. So you need to maintain that balance. And the parents should know and realize that when are the children crossing the line. So if the child is not really taking care of himself, he's not taking bath, his hair messy, he's not presentable, he won't have friends, he won't have colleagues, he won't make a good impact in his social environment, in the university, in his work environment, in all
in
cases,
life in general,
in
I would
life
say.
Overall, you know. So there needs to be a balance. But if someone is a spendthrift, that's the word we use in English, or someone who's doing israf, because in Quran we talk about israf, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says very clearly, those who do israf are the friends of shaitan, right?
Right.
So those who are doing israf, that is overspending in any area, be it your dressing, be it your eating, be it your hairstyling, be it your anything, watch, everything I'm talking about.
Right.
Let me just elaborate a little here on israf. If I need a car, the job of a car is to take you from one place to another place, right? So if I need a car and I know that I have a family of five, I need a car which is a 7-seater car, I should pick a car which is an okay car with an okay brand, probably a Ford or a GMC or whatever. But if I'm looking for a Bentley, or if I'm looking for a Mercedes, or if I'm looking for Maybach, and you know that kind of a brands, which is Rolls Royce, you know, and
right.
These are like... This is far, far beyond your status level.
For the average family.
Average family, exactly.
Because we would say a rich family, which has the means to do this.
And that's their status symbol.
Yeah.
That's their status requirement.
That's something
that's a different story.
Yeah.
But for an average middle-class family, a normal car would do, but they want a BMW and putting themselves through the struggle of, you know,
because
taking
of RIA,
car loans
in essence.
And in
yeah.
indulging themselves into show off and RIA, this is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says this is israf. This is beyond your need and requirement. This is beyond your necessity.
So if you circle back to the whole appearance theme, then if you want to look good, then should you not also want to look good for others as well?
And that's where I'm drawing the line. I'm saying that if you want to look good, it's okay to look good. But be sure not to cross the lines, right? Be sure not to spend too much on this. I'm sure you must have heard of this show called Dr. Phil.
Yes.
And he, you know, counsels the children and all that.
He says that he counseled, but I very much disagree with his methods.
I'm just referring to the kind of participants you get there. If you look
at
the kind of children, the teenagers that come there and the problems that they talk about, one of them is this very scenario, that overindulgence with themselves. I want to look good, and everybody should look at me only and nobody else.
Right.
So when will they
very
look
selfish,
at
egoistic very self-centered, attitude? Yeah.
Egoistic. It's all about me.
Narcissism. Yeah. In essence. Yeah.
Egotist. I wouldn't say egoistic, but I would say egotist. That's another level of egoism.
Interesting.
So totally about themselves. So this is where the parents need to notice that how much time is my child spending with himself, so that they know that the right time to stop the child from crossing the red line.
Right. And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now we are discussing how we can control our teenagers who are very easily, affected by fashion trends, and they constantly change their appearances. We said, la afrat wa la tafrit. Do not overspend or also underspend at the same time.
And this came from the fundamental idea of keep them busy, keep them involved, give them activities. And this is where I was talking about. Recently, I was watching an episode of Shark Tank, right? And there, the father walks in with a 12 or 13-year-old child and then, starts off the pitch with showing the product and then says, now my son will take over. And then the son runs the whole show. He talks about where they are manufacturing, who are their partners, where are they getting the investment from, how much have they invested so far, what are their quarterly returns and profits, and what is his future plan.
So he's basically a business partner.
And he was literally running the business as a CEO, and the sharks were surprised and like, how old are you? And they're like, I'm 12 or 13, something like that.
Yeah.
And they're like, you're 13 and you're running the show, you're running the whole business? And the father says, yes, he's my business partner. We are equal partners in it. He runs the business, right? So the teenagers, a lot of parents think that, oh, he's just 12. What does he know? What can he do? Let us not put lots of pressure on him, or let's not burden him with activities. Give him his free time. This is the time to enjoy. In future, he's going to be busy with life and work. He won't get time to enjoy. So give him the freedom. No, that's not it's all about. Give him a productive, healthy freedom. Give him that space where not just he's focused on his physical self, but his intellectual self. Give him that opportunity to indulge at intellectual level. So keep him involved into discussions at home. Keep him involved into discussions that are related to the father's job or the father's bank loan or mother's investment.
Right.
And future plan for the family by itself. That, look, we are a family. And what is the legacy that we want to leave behind, right?
Right.
So that way, keeping them busy physically and mentally and intellectually.
Yeah, but just about that, sort of an interruption, dear Sheikh. You say that we should keep them busy, but at the end of the day, we cannot keep them busy at all times. Wouldn't it be more productive to change the way that they are thinking when they are standing in front of the mirror? Because we do have a riwayah that, إِنَّ اللَّهَ جَمِيلٌ, Allah is beautiful, يُحِبُّ الْجَمَالِ, He loves beauty. He loves to see the fruit of the blessing, the bounties on his servants.
Correct.
So should we change the way that this man or this young teenager is dressing? Do that, but do it for Allah at least.
Correct.
Right?
That's in place. I mean, I'm talking about the families who are not so much into religion. Even for them...
Well, that's a very important distinction.
Exactly. Because even for them, the path is open. A lot of families, they say, okay, we're not very religious. We don't follow so much of Islam.
Right.
Even for you, there are ways to handle things. But the parents who are working on their children from the Islamic perspective and building their worldview from the Islamic point of view, everything comes back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Because I know some families who have children, they say, my child, my female daughter, she stands in front of the mirror, like, and she's so very minute and detailed when she's wearing her hijab that nothing is revealing.
Correct.
Or nothing is, and he's correct. Like, that is great.
That is great. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But see, there's a difference. Again, when you're doing it for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you're trying to protect yourself and maintaining hijab. That's one thing.
Right.
But
yeah.
being
doing it for others.
Doing it for others and self-indulgence. You know, even just the fact that, oh my God, I'm so beautiful.
Right.
I'm so handsome.
Yeah, that's the danger zone.
And you would see this on TikTok and YouTube videos, you know. Why are you talking to me? I'm so pretty. You're not even my type, you know. You're not even my from my league. So just stay away. And things like that. So this is where is the red line, that over self-indulgence so that you see yourself superior and others inferior.
Now, Sheikh, I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion, and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. In the United States, children of temporary visa holders who can't gain permanent residency in the U.S. are one of several groups urging the Biden administration to act on an immigration overhaul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Aishwarya Kavi. The piece is titled, They Grew Up Legally in the U.S., but can't stay after they turn 21. In 2011, after 5 years of working and living with his family in the United States on a temporary visa, Bharathi Mohan Ganesan submitted green card applications for his wife, his 5-year-old daughter, and his 11-year-old son. Mr. Ganesan, who was born in India and has also lived in Singapore and Australia, was nervous about when his wife and children might gain permanent residency of the United States. He knew the waiting list was especially long for Indians on his kind of visa, an H-1B, which allows American companies to employ skilled foreign workers. Because of chronic backlogs, it can take years to process those on work visas who apply for permanent residency. Last year, a decade after he applied, Mr. Ganesan, his wife and his daughter received their green cards. But his son had turned 21 and missed the cutoff by a matter of a few months, leaving him scrambling for a visa that would allow him to stay in the United States. Mr. Ganesan's son is among more than 200,000 children who grew up in the United States under the protection of their parents' temporary visas, which can be renewed indefinitely. But the children risk losing their legal status when they turn 21. Unable to become permanent residents of the United States because of the backlogs or because they were never eligible in the first place, they must obtain a different visa, remain in the United States without legal status, or leave the country entirely. According to the Cato Institute, more than 10,000 children aged out of green card eligibility each year. Untold numbers eventually depart the United States, often leaving their families behind. These young people do not qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA program, created by executive action during the Obama administration. The DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, protects from deportation about 650,000 youths, or DREAMers, who were brought into the United States and have remained without legal status. Because the program requires applicants to be undocumented, it does not offer those with legal status a way to stay in the United States. A comprehensive immigration overhaul is highly unlikely to pass a deadlocked Congress in a midterm election year. The Biden administration has been under increasing pressure as a Trump-era public health order, known as Title 42, is set to be lifted in late May, a move that is expected to create a surge of migration across the southwestern border of the United States. A bipartisan group of senators restarted immigration discussions on Thursday, 28th of April, to try to identify standalone proposals that would have the support of both political parties. When asked on Thursday, 28th of April, whether the Biden administration, which is updating the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the DACA program, was considering extending protections to documented youth, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, told the House Judiciary Committee that the department did not plan to do so. Its focus was to fortify the existing DACA program and shift responsibility for documented youths to Congress, he said, adding that their situation spoke to the imperative to pass immigration reform. In interviews, more than a dozen people who lived in the United States on temporary visas from a young age described their struggles with anxiety and the financial burden of navigating how to remain in the country they considered home. They are urging the Biden administration, if it will not provide a path to citizenship, to offer a way for them to legally remain in the country. Mr. Ganesan's son, Niranjan Bharathimohan, is able to stay in the United States until this November only, because immigration officials extended his dependent visa. Mr. Bharathimohan, a student at the University of Texas at Dallas, will have to go to Singapore, where he was born, to apply for a student visa that will allow him to return to the United States and finish his degree. his application might be rejected since he previously tried for a green card. He has shown an intent to immigrate to the United States, which is not allowed. Applicants may be asked to show that they intend to leave the country after completing their courses. Mr. Bharathi Mohan faces the prospect of being stuck in Singapore, where he has no family and no roots. How is he going to manage alone? Mr. Ganesan said. I was really devastated that just because of my country of birth, my son's opportunities are very limited in the United States. While there are protections to keep families together when parents move to the United States on temporary work visas, those end when children turn 21, because they are no longer considered part of the family unit. I don't think people who originally wrote the laws foresaw a situation where children brought here on visas would be raised and educated here, but not have a clear opportunity to stay and become American citizens, said Dip Patel, the founder of Improve the Dream, an organization that campaigns for a path to citizenship for those children. Dip Patel added, delay in taking action will not only lead to tearing more families apart, but also continue the immense emotional turmoil faced by thousands of families. At a Senate hearing in March, Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois and the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, the top Republican on the panel's Immigration Subcommittee, vowed to work on legislation to help people who had grown up in the United States without a clear path to U.S. citizenship. Muzaffar Chishti, the director of the Migration Policy Institute at the New York University School of Law, described the issue as one of many in a system that has not been truly updated since the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which established the pathways for legal immigration to the United States that are still in place. Short of a legislative overhaul of the system, Improve the Dream, the advocacy group, has worked to increase awareness of the issue and is urging the Biden administration to make changes. But children of non-immigrant visa holders have criticized the Biden administration for being too slow or unwilling to take action on proposed changes, such as the expansion of the DACA program to include documented youths. Among the proposals is one that would modify how U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services determines whether an applicant qualifies for a green card, allowing more children and minors to remain eligible as they near the age of 21. Another would classify applicants as children beyond their 21st birthday to keep them in line for a green card, which is the policy for those who are refugees or asylum seekers or are sponsored by relatives who are U.S. citizens. Matthew Burke, a spokesman for the Immigration Agency, said the Department of Homeland Security was keenly aware of the challenges for documented youths in the United States and was exploring legal methods to provide immigration relief to this population where possible.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.